I want to talk about this system, Babylon, and my title is The Past and Future of Babylon. I could have put present as well, as is on this booklet of ours, but mostly I'm focusing on past and present. And this message started when I listened to a June 2017 sermon from Mr. Steve Buchanan, one of our ministers, and his title was The Rise of Modern Babylon, which kind of intrigued me. So I listened to that one night sitting in the bed. And I have used a good bit from his message, and I've changed a good bit also, and I'm quite happy to share his link should you have interest in hearing his message about this. And we both follow our booklet that's on the screen. He pointed out, Mr. Buchanan, that Babylon is a word that has little meaning to anyone today. And that would be true if I used it in my office or if I heard it when I was in the Baptist church. Babylon, what does that mean? Very little meaning to anyone today, almost. And he asked the question, is that good or bad or doesn't matter? And I thought, well, let's see what God says in Revelation 18 as he addresses this system, Babylon. Revelation 18 and the first few verses there. So I'm in Revelation 18, 1. After these things, I saw an angel, another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. And look at this being as we read about. This is a spirit being, and this is part of the future that God is offering his people, having great authority. And the earth, the ground below this being as he came down, was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great, the system, Babylon the Great is fallen. Verse 4. Drop down to verse 4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her. And who is this addressed to? Is this addressed to the world? Not at all. Come out of her, my people. And the story of Revelation, as we look at it, is this book is not intended for the world. This is intended for God's church and God's people. The world does not understand it at all. I've commented about my older brother who is so religious. Taught himself Greek so he could read the Bible in the original language. He's a math professor, and he told me Revelation is not meant to be understood. It is non-decipherable. You cannot understand it. And so the question becomes, well, what's it there for them? So I heard another angel say, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, unless you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. And then verse 8 here. Therefore her plagues will come in one day. So this is interesting. What does this mean, and what's it talking about as we look ahead? Death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. The one day in this verse really means a short period of time. It will be quick when this system falls, when it falls. So we can ask the question, this doesn't sound like something we want to be part of. As God describes it, and he looks at his church and his people and says, come out of her. Don't participate, don't be part. And we have a strong caution from God here to his church to come out of something. And this is an end time setting. So we don't know exactly when that will be that this caution is given. Just what are we, I say possibly the end time church, as we look around at what society is doing and becoming, what are we to be sure that we come out of? You probably remember some history of Babylon in the Bible, as we focused on that before. This empire took the Jews captive. It was ruled by ancient king Nebuchadnezzar. The Babylonian Empire that fell to the Persian Empire. On our history books, Persian king Cyrus the Great. This happened in 539 BC. Babylon fell. It's gone. It's gone. There would seem to be nothing left to come out of, but God cautions his end time people, come out of her. Here in Revelation 18, we must avoid something. This system, what is it in our age? What should we be looking for? It made me think, most of you, if you're over about 30, I know some of us aren't, will remember someone named Saddam Hussein, president of Iraq until 2003. You might not know this, but he spent a lot of time reviving interest in his country in ancient Babylon. because he viewed Iraq and himself as the successors of Babylon. And that's geographically correct, but biblically not so. The Babylon that we're to avoid is not Iraq, is something else. Hussein's interest was rebuilding Babylon on its original site in Iraq, and he was unable to do so, which if he knew and believed the Bible, he would have realized, because God said that will never happen of this old ancient city. We could look there. It's in Isaiah 13. I won't turn there, 19 to 20. And here's what it says. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms. This was quite a place. I think, as we'll see, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride. And we know Babylonians are often described as Chaldeans, kind of another name. Will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, it will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation. So Saddam Hussein wasn't paying attention to that when he thought he would rebuild Babylon on its original site. It will never be rebuilt. So if that's the case, what are we supposed to avoid? What are we supposed to come out of? We might note that Babylon is mentioned 274 times in the Bible, suggesting it is something that God wants his church to know about. Something about Babylon to understand. What we find in Daniel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Revelation, key Old and New Testament books of prophecy. And I thought it might help if we ground ourselves with some history. For a long time, many historians and even biblical ones doubted that the city of Babylon ever really existed. Ever was really a place more than mythology. This capital of the biblically described most powerful empire at the time, which we now know and Saddam Hussein knew once did exist. I say we now know, we found that Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon was about 50 miles south of Baghdad. And let's see if I can do this very good. So I put a map on the screen there that shows Baghdad with a square around it and Babylon kind of in the middle of nowhere, 50 miles south of that, along a stretch of the Euphrates River. And I also put a square around Jerusalem there so you can see the distance that Babylon traveled to get to Jerusalem to defeat it and tear it down, and then the distance these Jews had to walk to go back to Babylon, their captivity. And this slide shows the area now with the modern borders around it. And you can see Baghdad is circled again. So Babylon was south of that. The east border of Iraq is there. And you see Iran along that border. And that becomes important for this story as well. So modern Iraq where this is. And how did we find that? How did we find that? The actual site was found by a German archaeologist named Robert Coldaway, who traveled to Iraq in the late 1800s. With over 200 men, and his sole purpose was finding Babylon, finding where this thing was that's mentioned in the Bible. And this is Robert Coldaway. He is an archaeologist, and here's early excavation in Iraq of this site in Babylon. And here we have some more with more done there. And you see on the right the relief of an animal, and a lot of the walls had had words on them, or their language writing that we could translate and learn more about this Babylon, this city that Coldaway had found and was excavating. And it is interesting, finds like this one, because we're seeing more and more of them, of things described in the Bible that people say, well, that's kind of a myth, it was never there. And yet they're becoming more and more common, that modern archaeologists are finding sites and artifacts described in the Bible, including where they're described as being. I think it's an important part of our time and our age that we're doing this. By 1900, Coldaway had recovered sufficient artifacts and writings to verify what he found was ancient Babylon, that he had found that. 1 year after that, a large stone pillar was found in Iran, so that's to the east, with what's called the Code of Hammurabi on it. And I brought a slide of this thing. So there's that obelisk, and there's a king sitting on top of it. This ruler, who's become known now as the, well, the best-known king of the first or the Amorite dynasty of Babylon, died about 1750 BC. Eventual translation of that code that you can see on the stone revealed it contains 282 laws by which this city that Koldewey found was governed. Laws, so it was very structured. Babylon, the pillar or obelisk, was moved by Iran by the Persians when they conquered Babylon and was found there in 1901. And then as it was translated, there's something curious about the laws on this stone. It has sufficient mirroring of God's Ten Commandments and other Old Testament biblical laws, you know, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, that some 19th century historians at the time, when it was translated, concluded that Moses must have used the code of Hammurabi to draft the Ten Commandments, which of course is biblically incorrect, but it raises a question. How might the Babylonians have gotten these laws and statutes of God long before Mount Sinai? So King Hammurabi ruled from about 1790 to 1750 when he died, and there is another Bible figure who lived during that time, and his name is Abraham. Abraham, whom God had made very wealthy. So let me ask a question. Just where was Abraham living at this time? And let's see what we find. Go to Genesis 11 with me and see what we find there. Genesis 11, and starting in verse 1. And so the section heading in my Bible above these verses is the Tower of Babel. So now you know where we are biblically. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. And things like this is what archaeologist Koldewey used to home in on where he was going to look for the city of Babylon. And they dwelt there, and then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly so that they're waterproof. They're protecting themselves from another flood if God was going to do that. They had brick for stone and they had asphalt or tar for mortar, an odd way to lay bricks. But they're making a structure that will be waterproof. And they said, come, let us now build a city for ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens, so we can run up this thing if God tries to flood us again. It was really a rebellious thing that they were doing. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city, and so this is the eternal, this is Yahweh, this is the God being who became Christ that we're reading about here, came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. And I wondered about this, and I saw this morning that new telescope, new Hubble generation of a sense, is up there, and we've got it up there, and I wonder what we'll see with that. And I wonder about the ability we have to produce artificial intelligence. And Mr. Talbot has a machine that understands my words and your words, and is translating that, so it's a transcript of what we say, and your iPhones and your laptops and your 767s and space shuttles. And I've asked the question with some of us, it's intriguing to me, how far this mind that God has given us, how far could humans go with it if they weren't bent on self-destruction, which we know where we're heading if God doesn't stop that. But here's what God says about that. Now, nothing that they suppose to do or propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us therefore go down and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, which means confusion, because the Lord confused the language of the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. So we've got all these people divided into groups by many languages, and it makes me think whenever I see this, that this is Babylon. These are the ones who started Trinity worship with Nimrod, Semiramis, and Tammuz. And then from that, mother-child worship, which has become so prominent in cultures everywhere. So we'll see these things in so many diverse cultures in Samaria and Egypt and the Greeks and the Romans, even in, among the Hindus in India. And you think, how could that be? Very similar Trinity worship among very different cultures. And if you confuse the language and each one think they're speaking the original and they go forward and carry the same beliefs they had, suddenly you have an explanation for what we see in different cultures and what they worship here. So we're reading what takes place where the city of Babylon will be built, and this name Babylon coming from Babel here, that Tower of Babel. And God decided it was time to put the brakes on this by giving them the multitude of languages here and all these trinities we find around the world now. And we know it's moved into the modern Christian church. Well, it did a long time ago. Makes us see that what we read in Genesis 11 really happened, or I think it's evidence that we did. But now look further down in this chapter in verse 27, in this same chapter. This is the genealogy of Terah. So that's Abraham's father. Here, genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram. Nahor and Haran. Haran begot Lot. So that's Abraham's nephew. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land. So let's see where they're living. In Ur of the Chaldeans. So they're living among the Chaldeans here. The inhabitants of Babylon are again often referred to as the Chaldeans. So we see here who Abram and his father were living with, and we can ask, how did King Hammurabi get God's laws and statutes on his pillar? And I'm just doing some hand-waving here because we really don't know, but first question we might ask, because this is long before Mount Sinai, did Abraham have God's laws and statutes, his commandments? We could go to Genesis 26, I won't do that, but this is where God made covenant promises to Abraham. And then he said why he chose Abraham. And his reason for choosing Abraham was, it's in verse 5 of chapter 26, because Abraham obeyed my laws, my commandments, and my statutes. And to do that, he had to have them. He had to know them to be able to do that. So this is a wealthy individual. Abraham was made very wealthy by God, who lived in the land of the Chaldeans. Before God sent him to Canaan, we're told Abraham's wealth and prominence brought him before rulers. And I think it was last week in Buford when Mr. Schallenberger was there, he mentioned or talked about Abraham in the presence of a Pharaoh. So how many times have I been in front of Mr. Putin? Well, none. Mr. Biden? None. So being in the presence of a Pharaoh is a big thing. And that's in Genesis 12 where Abraham was in front of some Pharaoh, I don't know which one it was, and that's one of the times when he told Sarah, his wife, tell him you're my sister. Not a good idea, but he did. And then we could move to Genesis 20, where he was in front of another king, and this time it's King Abimelech. And again, he asked Sarah to say that she was his sister and got in trouble doing that. So we see that Abraham was of sufficient prominence to find himself in front of very important people. And some speculate that Abraham may have spent time with Hammurabi, king of the Chaldeans, because of his wealth and prominence, during which they discussed God's laws, which is how they ended up on what's now called the Code of Hammurabi, still visible on that historic Babylonian obelisk that's on the screen that you can go to Iran and see the real thing if you want. And some also feel that God may have sent Abraham to Canaan when he did, because this ruler, this Babylonian ruler, Hammurabi, had become a dangerous person to Abraham. So what was Calderway in following archaeologists' work to reveal about biblical Babylon as we continue? What do we know about it? How much would people have been impressed as they approached this ancient city when it was still active and then entered the capital of the Babylonian Empire? There was a Greek historian named Herodotus who provided the earliest full description of the city in his work, Histories, and he described Babylon as a gigantic square. The city of Babylon is a gigantic square, each side measuring 120 stades, which is 13.2 miles on a side for this city. And there's an artist's view from what we know archaeologically of what Babylon might look like, looking down into Babylon. And for these artist renditions, you'll see that tower in there. There's the Tower of Babel enclosed in there that they made. And also you see the blue-fronted building toward the front. That's the gate of Ishtar, of their goddess, queen of heaven, Ishtar. And this is where the things we just saw on Beyond Today come from. This is where those dates came from. They didn't come from God's word. and they did highlight and worship some very, very downed things. So this city, if you ever watch a boat sail, you've probably heard this. You're at the beach and there's a boat with an 80-foot tall mast and there's a flag on top that you can see very well, and it sails straight out. As it goes, the flag gets lower and lower because of the curvature of the earth until it disappears. That only takes about 2.5 miles, and these walls around Babylon are more than 13 miles long. So if you stood along one of the walls and just looked, you would see it disappear in the distance as it went around the earth. So these are huge stone walls around this city. You see the Euphrates River going through it, which was a great resource to Babylon. And I think I have more of a close-up here. This is the Gate of Ishtar in an artist's rendition on the right. And in the middle is what's actually been excavated that the rendition is based on. On the left is the goddess Ishtar standing on the Lion of Babylon. So some idea of what Coldaway and others have found there so that we know that this was a real city. Those 13 miles on each side enclose 174 square miles for this city. Babylon dwarfed all other cities of the time. It's about two-thirds the size of modern New York City. And I wonder sometimes if this Ishtar's Gate is where the Jews were carried in as they came to this. So looking at this gave me a little bit more of a handle on what they faced. Herodotus described the stone walls around the city as 80 feet tall and wide enough that chariots and horses could be driven on top and able to pass each other as they met for that wall, as they patrolled for any threats to the city, ensuring safety of the city more. They had moats on all sides, surrounded by moats, and this is the place where the Jews were carried captive. Babylon was considered impenetrable. It's a place you cannot get into. It was home of one of the seven wonders of the world also that you've heard about, so I carried in a picture of that. And this again is based on an artist's rendition. It's the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. And note again, the tower is in the background that we see with this ancient civilization that carries through the Bible. Babylon, Babylon, Revelation 17, Revelation 13, the system that we want no part of. It was a beautiful place. It was a fantastic place, but ruthless for the Jews to be held captive, beginning about 597 BC and now verified as a once real place. They were wealthy, these peoples, almost beyond belief, which was in part fueled by their position where these rivers met, the Tigris and Euphrates. Much of their resources could be driven from that. The converging rivers used for irrigation, very productive agriculture. Read some about that in a little bit. Where else did they get their wealth? And the answer is that this is a system of Satan, and they were quite ruthless, and they conquered all they could. All the people around, and as they went into Judah and conquered them, I wonder if they knew what they were going to find there. Once they got there, as a relatively small nation of Judah, I'll just read from www.templemount.org. Although David, and this is King David, desired to build a permanent house of God in Jerusalem, his son Solomon built the first temple. Excuse me. The plans were those of David, and David amassed the materials. And it was quite a bit that he put together. We find that in 1 Chronicles 28, 2 Chronicles 2 to 4, 1 Kings 6 to 7. Don't worry, it'll pass. I do this in front of my students sometimes. These materials included 100,000 talents of gold. So a talent is about 130 pounds. 100,000 talents. 1 million talents of silver. That's 1 Chronicles 29. From his own private fortune, David also gave 3,000 talents of gold and 7,000 talents of silver. From David, I think it was Mr. Graby who gave a message not long ago that King David was probably the richest man the world has ever seen. For what he gave here, enormous total quantity of silver and gold by any standard, 100,000 talents of gold is 3,750 tons, the value of which today is in the multiple trillions of dollars. So that's where they got their wealth. Thanks, Bob. Just in case. So we know from history, thank you, sir, that in the Bible that Babylon fell to the Persians. Historians believe King Cyrus had his troops dig canals to divert the Euphrates River so that the water level fell and they could enter the impenetrable city that no one could take down. And Isaiah 44 alludes to that. Let's go there and look and see what we find in Isaiah 44. This is long before it actually happened. Isaiah 44, and I look in 24, verse 24 to start, just so we see who's talking. Therefore says the Lord your Redeemer, and we see this is again the eternal Yahweh, and he who formed you from the womb, I am the Lord. So that's who's talking here. And then in verse 26, who confirms or makes happen the word of his servant and performs the counsel of his messengers, who says to Jerusalem, you shall be inhabited. So this is the time he's speaking of the Babylonian captivity, where they're not there anymore and the city has been laid waste. He says, you shall be inhabited. To the cities of Judah you shall be rebuilt, and I will raise up your waste places that the Babylonian conquest made, who says to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up your rivers, who says of Cyrus. So here we have the man who will do it, named by name, about 200 years before it actually happened. He is my shepherd, and he shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and to the temple your foundation shall be laid. He's telling them, I will bring you back out of Babylon, and you will be rebuilt. First verse of 45, thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him and loose the armor of kings, to open before him the double doors, like we have at this gate of Ishtar, so that the gates will not be shut. We find here, historian Daniel Potts, this is 1996, recorded his belief that they were able to drop the river to mid-thigh level, just above the knee, so that the Persians could enter the city under the wall with the cover of darkness. This being not too long after Nebuchadnezzar, it was the time of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. The Jews had been exiled to this city and empire at its peak of power, the capital of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. It's okay, after reviewing this history of what Babylon was and the fall of Babylon, why does Revelation 18, the end times, say Babylon is fallen? We'll have that twice. Is fallen. And why are end time members of the Church of God told to have no part of her? And the answer is, this great empire, which is Satan's system, has returned in cycles through history, has dominated history, and is going to return in earnest one last time. That's what we're being told to stay out of. We know this was shown by the statue of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and that was interpreted by Daniel. The statue's head, he was told, was representing Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire, and other parts represented kingdoms that we now see in history, which hadn't shown up at that time. And this is part of why some people say the book of Daniel obviously wasn't written when it appears to be written, because it portrays too accurately what came next. That doesn't matter. It portrays all the way up to our day. So after Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus, and the Medo-Persian Empire Alexander and the Greek Empire and the mighty Roman Empire. We're familiar with all these. Then seven resurrections of the Roman Empire, six of which have come and gone in history. I did a message on this not too long ago showing those empires and that they are there, predicted by Nebuchadnezzar's dream, where they should be. And the reality of that in history absolutely proves God's word, and that each of these seven resurrections was associated with a false church and false days of a moon goddess, Ishtar, Easter, still here, is still here, and of a sun god, Nimrod, whose birthday was on December 25th. I just did a quick search. There so much comes up. I mentioned if you search on sun god December 25th, this picture of Nimrod is on many sites. I circled the December 25th birthday as the Beyond Today indicated. This is long before Christ. And there is the original trinity of Semiramis, Nimrod, and Tammuz. Both Nimrod and Tammuz were to have been born on December 25th, long before that day was placed as Christ's birthday. And that little table came up of different pagan gods born on December 25th. I didn't know that. I didn't know the history of that day for so long. And this day carried forward through history until the church of this system, the system that associated itself with all these resurrections through history, maneuvered to place Christ's name on what is a historically awful pagan date that I alluded to some before I started, the seemingly innocent Easter and Christmas. As pretty as they are, the system of Satan, Babylon, not the ancient capital that's gone, but the system is going to rise. But it is still here. We still find these marks of the system in our modern society. And I will say that if you do this historic search and look at the resurrections of the Roman Empire through history up till modern times, every one of them associated themselves with the same church. And it was the Catholic Church. And if you look at how they interacted together, popes often crowned the rulers of those dynasties, and the rulers often helped pick the pope. So the associations are clear. It's still here. We can see them. And through that church, they've helped mix Babylon into the modern church, which we find now. And it will suddenly rise in great strength at the time of the end and great power, such that the world will say, who is like it? Who is like this? They will be enthralled with it. They will worship it. And God's people are told to avoid this system that's coming, what will be a greatly deceptive system of Satan until God cuts it down for all time. So we know that God established his church, which he describes as a small flock. The small church remained throughout history and was often severely persecuted by Satan's Babylonian system, by the prophesied resurrections of this system. And then we find the modern historic descendants, the Church of God today, described in the book of Revelation as the Church of God remaining at the end time. Go back to Revelation, the first chapter, and note the language of this book. I consider again my older brother, and you cannot understand this book. It is indecipherable. Revelation 1, verse 1, the revelation, and the word means the revealing of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show who? Not the world. Again, the book is not for the world, to show his servants. And what's the time setting for when this revelation, this revealing will occur? Things which must shortly take place. So we're at the time of the end where this book is going to be opened up. His servants, his people, this is the church. Things which must shortly come to pass, end times things, being revealed to descendants of the original church established by Christ. So we have the Church of God. Church of God at Ephesus, Church of God at Philippi, Church of God at Corinth, Church of God at Rome. And I look at all the names of churches I pass on the road as we go places, and they don't follow. All churches in the Bible are named Church of God, which is why we call ourselves Church of God at Buford, Church of God at Atlanta. all these churches as we follow forward. Verse 3 here, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near. So we have that placing of time again. God's people at the end of the age is what this is for. Verse 9, I, John, your brother and companion in the tribulation and kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ, was on the island that is called Patmos. And why was he there? For the word of God and for the testimony of Jesus Christ. The word of God and the testimony of Christ. And I might ask, what is the testimony of Christ that he's there for to record and deliver? It becomes important because it is for the church of God. It's for his people. It's what John starts with in verse 1. The revelation of Christ is the revealing of Christ. Christ's testimony that comes to God's people in this book we're now looking into. And if we look more, we find this testimony mentioned several times in Revelation, always in the context of not the world, but God's people. Let's consider another in Revelation 19. Revelation 19 and verse 7. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come. So what people are the subject here? His wife has made herself ready. This again is the church. This is God's small body of believers. And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, because God sees these people very highly, very special. And he put them in fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteous act of the saints. Then he said to me, to John, write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper. So this is God's church, God's people, at the end time of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true sayings of God. And then John said, I fell at the feet to worship him. This is the angelic being who was revealing this to him. But the angel said, don't do that. I am your fellow servant and of your brethren who have testimony of Jesus. Worship God. And then it's interesting to me too how many images you can find online of people on their knees before the Pope or before cardinals or other Catholics. And here even an angel says, don't do that. And we see Peter and others pull people up. Don't fall to worship me, worship God. And then he says, for the testimony of Jesus Christ, and now here we have it defined, is the spirit of prophecy. The angel reveals to John the testimony of Jesus, as alluded to in Revelation 1:1, the revealing is the spirit of prophecy, the understanding of prophecy. Do we find that same message elsewhere? And we could go to Amos 3:7, I won't go there, but it says, surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets. And there are many things that separate the church of God from mainstream churches. And I said before, the people there, many of them are better people than me. And I don't really know why God reveals what he does to whom he chooses. When I mentioned my friend who sold his house to become a missionary, I've never sold mine, but he doesn't have these things. Many things that separates the church of God from mainstream churches. And one is the understanding of prophecy. And I don't mean perfectly by any means, but enough to understand God's true plan, to know what God is doing, to pretty much understand what it's about, and to also understand what's coming and why. And that'll be so valuable when this system does fall apart around us. It's a remarkably special gift to God's people, the understanding of prophecy. This does include the descendants of Abraham and what they're promised, the great physical blessings by God, but they didn't lose it, but it was put on hold for a while because of their disobedience. And the 10 tribes went into captivity to the Assyrians, were aware of Judah about 100 years later to Babylon, group I'm talking about today. And God's promises were not removed. He bound himself to carry them out. And he would, but they are withheld for a time. And I'm just going to say right now, you can go to the United States and Great Britain and prophecy and get all the details of how this happened. They were withheld for seven prophetic times, which is seven times 360 years, or 2,520 years. And this brings us to a time in the early 1800s when suddenly Great Britain and the United States just boomed onto the scene out of nowhere with untold wealth to become the two greatest powers in the world as they came onto the world scene. And the reason I mention that, because again, it's really not my point today, but I wanted to mention it because ancient Babylon was cursed for this same period of time. And when the curse is over, the suggestion is that they might boom back onto the scene as well. So that's why I wanted to look at that. It becomes important to their final appearance and jumping into power after 2,520 years, beginning with their fall. So let's go to Daniel 4. And much parallel to Revelation in this book, but Daniel 4. And what we have here, I'll just say, is another dream of Nebuchadnezzar. And in verses 4 to 5, Nebuchadnezzar says, I have a dream and it has scared me. I'm afraid. And he should have been, because it was showing the coming end of his kingdom. And in verses 6 to 9, he called his astrologers to interpret his dream, and they couldn't do it. So as before, Daniel was called, and Nebuchadnezzar tells him what he's dreamed. Starting in verse 10, these were the visions of my head while on my bed. I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. And I'll just say now, this tree is Nebuchadnezzar. And it's also Babylon. And this is like Revelation. I can't say that because I can't interpret this either. So we have to let the Bible interpret itself. And you'll see that it does. It tells us. As it tells us what Revelation means, we don't figure it out ourselves. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were lovely. Its fruit abundant. So this is that agricultural system of Babylon. They really had it. And it was food for all. The beasts of the field were found shade under it. The birds of heaven dwelt in the branches. These are peoples they brought in captivity back to them. And all flesh was fed from it. And I saw in the visions of my head while on the bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. So this watcher is an angelic being. And then more of the dream is described to Daniel in verse 14 and following verses. He cried aloud, this is the angel, and said thus, this is the dream that scared Nebuchadnezzar, chop down the tree, cut off its branches, strip off its leaves, and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get out from under it, and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump, because it's coming back. Because it's coming back, and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of the heaven. And we're moving to the application of this to Nebuchadnezzar. Let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast, and let seven times pass over him. This decision is by decree of these angelic beings who have come down to tell us of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know. So we've got a very proud individual in Nebuchadnezzar here, that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. So don't think you're so wonderful because I have let you be in this position. And then we have Daniel telling what the dream means in 19. So we don't know until the Bible tells us. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, so this is the name of one of Nebuchadnezzar's gods that Nebuchadnezzar put on Daniel, was astonished when he heard this dream, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. And we can find other verses, translations that say he was stupefied for an hour. He didn't know what to say to the king. He didn't know what to say. Continuing in 19, so the king spoke, he's picking up on this, and he says, so Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. And Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, May this dream be for somebody else. May the dream concern those who hate you and its interpretation concern your enemies. May it be for someone else. The tree that you saw, which grew and became strong and whose height reached to the heavens and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the heaven had their home. It is you, O King. So that's how I knew, because the Bible tells us, as we continue reading, who have grown strong and have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, to the sky, your dominion to the end of the earth. Nebuchadnezzar was the tree that would be chopped down, and then we have the prophesied 7 years where Nebuchadnezzar would lose his sanity and live like a beast in the field, in which, after which God would give the kingdom back to him, would restore it to him. This was to teach humility to a man filled with pride. Verse 23, and inasmuch as the Lord saw, as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of the heaven. And let him graze with the beasts of the field till 7 times pass over. This is the interpretation, O King, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon you. My Lord the King, they shall drive you from men. Your dwelling place shall be the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of the heaven, and 7 times shall pass over you till you know the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. And inasmuch as they give the command to leave the stump and the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you. God's going to give it back after you come to know that heaven rules. And we could read the following verses where this happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And after 7 years, God restored him, restored his mind and sanity, and he praised God. But more than Nebuchadnezzar is represented here, the tree also appears to foreshadow the end time Babylon as we move forward. The system that will appear again, the one we are told to stay out of in chapter 5. So here Nebuchadnezzar is now dead and his successor is on the throne. Verse 1, Belshazzar, so this is not Belteshazzar, this is not Daniel, this is the successor to Nebuchadnezzar. The king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command, this is not a good thing, to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem. So these are holy things to God, these vessels, that the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines might drink from them. And they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of God, from the house of God which had been in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank wine from them. And worse than that, they drank wine and they praised their gods, the gods of gold and of silver and of bronze and of iron and stone. So here they are desecrating things taken from God's Jerusalem temple, including praising their false gods with them. And then we have the famous handwriting on the wall that we see. I think I brought a picture, an artist's rendition of that, the handwriting on the wall where this phrase comes from. In verse 5, as this king had done this and desecrated things from the temple, in the same hours, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite them. And you might think, how would you respond if you saw this? The lampstand on the plaster on the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed. He was scared to death, basically. His thoughts troubled him. So that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other as he was shaking from the fear of what he was seeing. And once again, if we continue, the king's astrologers couldn't read the words. They couldn't read what was written on that wall or explain it, and so Daniel was called by the king. This king, who apparently had heard of Daniel but never felt it worth the time to get to know him, to meet him. In verse 13, Daniel is called, and Daniel was brought before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you this one who I've heard about? Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah whom my father the king brought from Judah?" Apparently, Daniel had been reduced to a much lower position at this time. After the death of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar offered to restore his position if he could interpret what was written on that wall beside them, the handwriting. And notice what Daniel said in verse 17 about this offer. Daniel answered and said to the king, "You keep it. I don't want it." Daniel knew what was going on here. "Let your gift be for yourself. Give your rewards to another. Yet I will tell you what is written there. I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation." And then he actually does this, starting in verse 25. So let's see what Daniel says here. "This is the inscription that was written: Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin," are the words written there. This isn't the interpretation of each word. "Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. It's over. Babylon is coming down. It's over. It's ended. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Phares, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians." And so historically, we know this is what happened. The Phares in this verse has the same root as Pharsin or Upharsin earlier, and means divided or cut in two. And Belshazzar was killed that same night as the Medo-Persian Empire took Babylon. So now let me summarize some from our Bible commentary for Daniel 5, but I encourage your looking at this amazing prophecy. In the handwriting, in this verse we just read, "Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin," God numbered Babylon, and many means counted out. Belshazzar's reign had been counted out like counting out a boxer. It was over. These three words are also monetary units in Babylon. In addition to being numbered, Daniel said that Babylon had been weighed in the balance, as with silver and gold coins. And this slide, I've added the number of shekels, Babylonian shekels, that each of these words is equivalent to, and you see it's 126 in total. If this was United States money and I said $25.20, you might say, well, that's 2,520 pennies, if that was an important number, 2520. And the same is happening here. If we convert 126 shekels to the base Babylonian currency, which is the gerah, we get that interesting number that we've seen before, 2,520. Here's what was written on that wall. And I'll just quote from our commentary. "This would seem to parallel the prophesied explanation of seven times in Daniel 4 that we read about for Nebuchadnezzar, which turned to be seven real years for King Nebuchadnezzar and seven prophetic years for Babylon, with seven times 360 equaling 2520, possibly meaning a 2520-year judgment on Babylon from its ancient fall to modern times. And our commentary indicates, as it should, as with much of prophecy, we can't be sure. We can't be sure if this is the intent of the writing, but the total coming from the number of shekels seems an unlikely coincidence, is what our commentary says, and therefore of possible importance. So with this, let's go back to where we started and look in Revelation. Go to Revelation 14. And here we have an apostle John writing, approximately 90 years old at this point. It's about 90 AD, about a Babylon vision for many years hence. So he's moving us forward to the time of the end. And this same Babylon, adding 2,520 years, if we do seven prophetic times to the 539 BC fall of ancient Babylon, brings us to 1982, And for those of you who have been around for a long time, you know the church looked toward that year for a long time with the idea, let's see what happens. In 1982, did anything significant happen then? Not that we know of. I guess is the best answer I have. Not that we know of, but maybe one notable thing. And this is the year that Pope John Paul II gave a speech in Europe where he implored the peoples. It's an interesting speech to listen to return to your roots. And what are their roots? Well, it's Babylon. We don't know if this year started the tree growing again. And this system prophetically booming onto the scene. We are aware that Europe has been changing as we've watched, and they now have a platform of the European Union. Revelation 14, where we are, verse 8, and another angel follows saying, Babylon is fallen. Same words as Revelation 18, where we started, that great city, because she has made all nations drunk with her false church message. Fornicated from the pagans, drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. She has made all them drunk. They are all following this. Babylon is fallen. But then there's more here in Revelation 14, verse 9. Then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast. Okay, so I don't have time to go into this, but many of you understand Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 picture a beast that is identified as being this Babylonian system. This beast is the same beast of those two chapters of Revelation, and for that matter, Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 that we're running into. It's a beast with seven heads and 10 horns. And as mysterious as it sounds, it shows the succession of the Babylonian Empire through history, the final seven being European restorations of the beast of iron, the Roman Empire. And so if we look in history and just ask, who was there? Who came up? Here are the empires that came up after the Roman Empire fell in 476 when it received this mortal wound, which Revelation says will be healed. And then we see these empires, and each one of these empires that came associated itself with a church, as I've already mentioned, which was that Catholic Church, and each of these empires possessed that all-important city, Rome, that we see, and I spoke about that too not too long ago in a message called Ten Horns, and we have considerable literature explaining this progression toward the final Babylon. So Revelation 13 does describe this great beast rising one last time at the end. It will have among its horns the small horn that speaks blasphemous things, the false religious leader. And I think we know this, who with a military leader, as we move forward, will enforce the religion of Babylon, will enforce the religion of Satan. The system will be opposed to God. The religious part will enforce the days that came out of Babylon, Ishtar, Easter, which is done away with Passover. I never really knew what Passover was in the Baptist Church. We had Easter. And the birthday of the sun god, Christmas. Christmas Day. And the day of worship, of sun worship, Sun Day. And we know Constantine did this with a pope to worship on the venerable day of the sun. And God says, don't partake. Avoid this counterfeit. Why? Because it masks the truth. So let's finish where we started in Revelation 18. Revelation 18, same verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon, the great is fallen. And we reviewed the first fall and the second fall. The final fall is coming, the fall of Satan's system. Verse 3, for all the nations have been confused by this. And the days of Babylon are everywhere, and we think they're good. have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. It's Babylon returned, and the earth will love her. It will be a terribly immoral and deceived system, as we can see around us the way we're thinking. Continued deception by Satan and hiding of the truth and the plan of God, which is the point of all this. We're not to let this coming system steal away the truth from us. What do you have to prevent that? And we've seen that. You have the testimony of Christ, being among the very few who know ahead of time not to partake in what's coming. Verse 4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. Come out of her, my people. Hold on to the truth and to that crown and great reward Christ and God are working to give the first fruits, his church, who can fully recognize and understand the evil of the coming last Babylon.